That's it for this edition of Making Contact. A very special thanks to the panelists, the Media Consortium, Joe Ellen Kaiser, Manolia Charlatan, and Paul Stewart for audio sweetening. If this episode inspires you to dig deeper into independent media, and you feel you may want to pitch or produce something, share your ideas and reach out to us on our website, radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Marie Che, Anita Johnson, and Monica Lopez are our producers. Sabine Blazan is our audience engagement manager, and Vera Tykulsker is our development associate. I'm your host, RJ Lozada, and thank you for listening to Making Contact.
I'm out to sing songs. It will prove to you that this is your world. And that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KABU.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe. Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, March 31st, 2017, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio, your sanctuary radio, your resistance radio, at 90.7 FM on the air, KBOO.FM everywhere. Weather for today, we have for Friday, patchy fog before 11, and so get out there and enjoy that fog, because soon it will be 11 o'clock and it'll be all over. That said, we could see sunny skies later in the day with a high around 61, calm winds, and tonight overcast skies and a low around 46. Saturday, there is a slight chance of rain. Otherwise, a high around 59. And for tomorrow night, lows around 47. And Sunday, partly sunny skies again with a high around 57. And Sunday night brings a slight chance of showers, overcast skies, and low around 43. That's it through the weekend, bringing us full circle to Monday morning again. I have a terrifically exciting guest today. We're going to be speaking with Stephen Volker. He is the attorney for the Indigenous Environment Network, and he filed suit this week. The suit alleges that the State Department's final supplemental environmental impact statement, this is regarding, of course, the Keystone XL, this lawsuit, and it alleges that the State Department's final supplemental environmental impact statement fails, one, to provide a detailed and independent project purpose and need, and two, analyze all reasonable alternatives to the project, and three, stand by to hear Stephen himself go through it with you, and we'll all come to an understanding of exactly what the proponents of the doomed Keystone and XL, exactly what they are up against. First, very, very briefly, I just want to touch on a couple of headlines. I know that Mr. Volker is very kindly and patiently standing by. The New York legislature is eyeing single-payer health care, and because how on earth are they going to obtain coverage for huge numbers of people. And a key new supporter just joined the party, but the GOP-controlled state Senate seems like it's going to be a pretty high hurdle. Scott Pruitt, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, has moved late on Wednesday of this week to reject scientific conclusions of the agency's own chemical safety experts, who under Obama's time in office recommended that one of the nation's most widely used insecticides, DDT, be permanently banned at farms nationwide. Okay, Pruitt wants to take that one down. Moving right along, White House officials helped give Devin Nunes intelligence report. This is such a bizarre and convoluted story. It's difficult to know where it begins and ends. The latest twist was after March 21st when Devin Nunes got a call from a person he has described only as a source. Of course, the New York Times immediately outed the source. The call came as he was riding across town, D.C., in an Uber car at night. He quickly diverted to the White House. The next day, Nunes gave a hastily arranged news conference before going in to brief Trump on what he had learned late the night before. What he learned from White House officials. So he's briefing Trump on what he learned from White House officials, the chain of events. And so it was detailed to the New York Times by four American officials, mentioning that because of the secrecy and non-secrecy that surrounds this whole story. Since disclosing the existence of the intelligence reports, Nunes has refused to identify his sources. He says he's going to protect them. And everyone knows that Devin Nunes would snitch out pretty much anybody to save his own hide. So he says that he's protecting them so that others would feel safe to go to the committee with sensitive information. And there's none other than Michael Flynn immediately put his hand in the air and said, over here, but you got to protect me from prosecution or I won't talk. That's a separate story, of course, or maybe it isn't. He needs to put in his public comments, though, Nunes described his sources as whistleblowers, trying to expose wrongdoing at great risk to themselves. The FBI investigation into possible Trump campaign coordination with Russia and claims by the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee raised questions, though that doesn't appear to be the case. Several current American officials identified the White House sources as Ezra Cohen-Weltnick, the senior director for intelligence at the National Security Council, and Mike Lillis, an attorney working on national security issues at the White House counsel's office. They were previously counsel to Nunes' committee. Neither has been accused of breaking any laws. And they do appear to have sought to use intelligence to advance the political goals of, wait for it, of course, the Trump administration. If you had trouble following it, don't worry. Many other people also share your confusion. Here to enlighten us on what's going on, it's a lot simpler because, as we all know, the Keystone XL is not in any way, shape, or form in that national interest either as far as energy is concerned or as protecting the environment. Stephen Volker is here to talk with us about that today. Good morning, Mr. Volker, and thank you so many times over for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Chris.
Well, amid all the madness in Washington, D.C., there's madness cutting straight through the heart of the country. Why they need to bring tar sand from Alberta down to the Gulf Coast refineries at enormous risk is inconceivably foolish. Can you talk a little bit about the main points in the lawsuit?
I'd be happy to. This is an unnecessary project, it would unleash potentially 240 gigatons of carbon, which is far more than would be required to push the planet over the 2 degrees Celsius increase, which most climate scientists agree is the tipping point beyond which we will hurtle the planet into inexorable climate change and global warming.
Could you just say how much, again, how much carbon is being released? Because that's an enormous number, difficult for many people to comprehend, just in passing.
Yes. A gigaton is 1 billion tons. It uses the British definition of ton, which is in kilograms. So 1,000 kilograms, 2,200 pounds. And the project would make available for consumption worldwide 240 gigatons of carbon. That's the quantity in the Alberta tar sands. The development of the tar sands already has destroyed 1,000 square miles. If you look at an image from Google Earth, you see an area roughly 50 miles from east to west and 20 miles from north to south that's completely obliterated of all life. It is one big black blotch, a blight on the universe caused by uncontrolled mining of tar sands. Tar sands, as many of the listeners are aware, consume far more energy in their processing and release more pollution in their use than any other form of petroleum. This pipeline that was approved on March 23 by the State Department and at the direction of President Trump would cross 875 miles of lands that are used for agriculture, for ranching, for fisheries, for recreation. It would cross the country's most important clean water aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer, which spans several states in the High Plains region of the country. It would cross more than 1,000 water bodies in the three states, Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska. And it would jeopardize clean water in all of those water bodies, the groundwater and surface waters as well, including, I might add, the Missouri River, one of the most important waterways in the country. The groups I represent include Native American tribes and tribal leaders from both Canada and the United States, who have gathered together since 1990 in a coalition known as the Indigenous Environmental Network. I also represent the North Coast Rivers Alliance, which has members in the Pacific Northwest, California, Montana, and Alberta, Canada. All of these good folks have come together to oppose this needless destruction of boreal forest in Canada and the unnecessary risk posed to clean water and indeed to the survival of our planet by this boondoggle. At most, the project would create perhaps 35 permanent jobs, and it would potentially cost hundreds of thousands of folks their jobs in the alternative energy fields, for example, rooftop solar, as well as primarily in the agricultural arena. So we see a foolish decision made at the behest of economic interest that would take billions of dollars in profit at the expense of public safety.
And, of course, what about treaties? This must surely violate any number of First Nations treaties.
Well, I can tell you it certainly violates a treaty among the so-called modern or developed nations. It's called the Migratory Bird Treaty. That was adopted by Britain, the United States, Canada, Russia, and Mexico about 100 years ago. And that treaty forbids actions which foreseeably kill migratory birds. This project, if approved, would kill millions of birds. We have many documented losses of thousands of birds from the existing tar sands development. In one incident alone, over 1,600 mallard ducks were killed when they landed in one of the toxic ponds maintained by the developers of the tar sands. It's estimated that if all of the tar sands are developed, that hundreds of millions of birds would be killed. They would lose their winter breeding grounds, and they would be fooled into landing on the toxic waste ponds, which, as I indicated, already aggregate over 1,000 square miles in size. These ponds not only have floating hydrocarbons, which coat the feathers of the birds, rendering them unprotected against cold, but also they discharge excessive quantities of sulfur dioxide, which, if inhaled, can cause death as well.
We have to stop there. I apologize for that. That's a lot for people to take in. That's a tremendous, tremendous.